Good morning and welcome to the May 5th edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger. Good morning, everyone.
We've got a good show coming up today. We're going to start by speaking with author Peter Hayes about his new book, Profits and Persecution, German Big Business in the Nazi Economy and the Holocaust.
And then we'll speak with Daryl Huntsman from CO2 Sync. And we'll finish our hour by speaking with WLS Area Director Julianne Caron about their new Hungry app. All this and more on Mountain Money. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. The rise of Adolf Hitler and the move toward a directed German economy was not something that German big business necessarily embraced at the outset. Nonetheless, the German business community was a crucial element of Hitler's war effort, cooperating with the Nazi regime in the prosecution of the war and the persecution of Jews and others. So how and why did German business fall in line with the Nazis? And what were the ramifications during the war and its aftermath? We're lucky to be joined this morning by Professor Peter Hayes, author of the new book, Profits and Persecution, German Big Business in the Nazi Economy and the Holocaust. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning, Roger. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. So what motivated you to write this book and how long did it take to do the research?
Well, the original motivation was I was a graduate student and was looking around for something to write my dissertation on.
You got to find something.
But I had an advisor who quite smartly said, you know, we put a bunch of these executives on trial after the war and we compiled this massive documentary record and no one's ever looked at it. So that started me on a project that became my first book, which was about IG Farben, a giant chemicals company. At the time, it was the largest publicly traded company in Europe. And that led to further studies of other corporations and so forth. And then finally in 1998, 27 years ago, I signed a contract to write this book. So the motivation after that was to keep my promise. And that's what I did at long last. I got distracted by a couple of other projects along the way.
Okay, so let's set the stage a bit with respect to the role of large business in the German economy in the 20s and 30s. So do you have the situation after the First World War? Germany is where it is. Shed a little light on where big business was during that time frame.
Well, the 1920s were a very rocky time in the German economy, and German businesses had to cope with an overall problem of overcapacity. They all had more factory capacity to produce goods than they had markets to sell them in. And this led to a lot of competition among firms to try to figure out how to handle that. They handled it largely through developing a system that historians call organized capitalism. That is a system in which competition among the firms was less than we expect when we think of a capitalist system, because there were all kinds of market sharing and pooling agreements and so forth. There were many cartels. This made the influence of the largest firms in every industry pretty decisive in negotiating with the government and so forth. So it was a kind of capitalism that was different from what we're used to in the United States since the Second World War. It meant that companies had collective interests in dealing with the government, and the government in the 1920s was more interested by political outcomes than it was by theories of what was good for production and so forth. This led to the development of a system of arbitration. And so when labor and management negotiated about wages, they didn't do it independently. They did it under the supervision of government arbitrators. Business hated this system. It made them mistrustful of democracy and of government intervention in the economy. And that was kind of the background to the attitudes of business as Adolf Hitler began to rise. They did not like the economic environment created by democracy, but on the other hand, they weren't quite sure they liked what Adolf Hitler was offering either, because he favored a protectionist economy, one in which there would be high barriers to imports. He favored concentration on in domestic production and not trading on international markets and selling goods abroad. He was an interventionist. He regarded the state as it'd be very important for the state to control the decisions of private enterprise. And what this meant was a kind of neutralization of big business in German democratic politics leading up to Hitler's rise in 1933. They didn't trust Hitler. They didn't like the regime they had. They kind of were paralyzed about what to do.
So I guess this, it was sort of a standoffish kind of approach as we go through, as we get to the late 1930s. Big business perceived ultimately that there were both benefits and drawbacks to the Hitler regime that was coming into power?
Indeed. They expected that the regime was going to be good for them in that it would probably smash the trade unions and end the arbitration system about wages and hours and so forth, and that would be to their advantage. But there might be disadvantages in terms of interference in markets. There would be adverse effects for companies that sold a lot of their production abroad. Mm-hmm. This was particularly true of chemical companies, some electronics companies that are still famous today, like Siemens. These companies tended to think that Hitler would be, on balance, more bad than good, whereas producers of coal and steel and some of those commodities thought, oh, well, on balance, he might be more good than bad. And that was pretty much the terrain. There was only one major industrialist who contributed heavily to the Nazi Party. That was a guy named Fritz Thyssen. But most of the other big business firms and their leaders tended to put their money behind middle-of-the-road, right-of-center parties that they thought they could trust.
And as things rise and Hitler comes into power and starts imposing things on companies, and we'll get to more of that in a minute, to what extent did conservatives such as, you talk about Franz von Papen and other conservatives who thought they could either tame or, I think you used the word, frame in Hitler. What did they mean by that and why did they think that?
Well, a lot of them knew that Hitler was uneducated, that he had never had a real job since he had been mustered out of the army at the end of World War I. He'd been a political agitator that whole time. He had no formal education. And no experience running any kind of government office and so forth. So they thought he's kind of an amateur. He's a hothead. He's awash with his own ideas about how economies work and so forth, but has no experience. So we'll basically show him how it's done, and he'll be putty in our hands. And of course, this comes under the heading of famous last words, because he was appointed to be the prime minister on January 30th, 1933, and by the beginning of June, he had turned Germany into a one-party state. He'd completely outmaneuvered all those people who thought they would have him enclosed, because those people thought Hitler's going to be the prime minister like any other prime minister. He's going to have a cabinet. Most of the people in the cabinet who were appointed with him on January 30th, 1933, were not Nazis. We'll be able to outvote him, is what was the craziest idea they had, and he basically outmaneuvered them all.
Okay, so he starts to impose some interesting economic policies. What tools did the regime deploy to force compliance with those policies? You know, things like the removal of Jews from senior management roles.
Well, there were two main tools at the beginning. One was a measure of bullying. They basically did a lot of things that were to threaten force about to companies. For instance, when board meetings were held in February or March of 1933, often stormtroopers would march into the hall and surround the directors meeting there and act menacing. That would be sufficient form of intimidation. They had, in Germany, chambers of commerce are different from what they are here. They're quasi-governmental institutions. They register firms, they record when firms are dissolved and so on. They have boards. The Nazis basically marched into meetings of the chambers of commerce in all the major cities and demanded that the non-Nazis resign. And in Frankfurt, for instance, one of the major commercial cities of Germany, not only did they do that, but when the non-Nazis did comply and resign, they marched them through the streets as a kind of public humiliation. They threatened various business managers with investigations. We're gonna trump up charges of bribery against you, where you supposedly bribed officials of the preceding democratic regime, and we'll put you on trial and you'll have to go to all that expense and so forth. So bullying was a big part of it in the spring of 1933. The other big part of it was government money. What they basically did is they cut firms that didn't comply with their demands right away off from government contracts. And this could be anything as minor as if you were a seller of paper to a government office. If you were owned by a Jew, they would immediately terminate the contract. If you were owned by, you were not owned by a Jew, but you had a Jewish chief manager, they would immediately terminate the contract. And then it was some big firms were affected. All the big construction firms in Germany were looking forward to jobs in the spring of 1933, sort of, you know, plugging the potholes in the roads and resurfacing things and so forth. And the Nazis made clear right away that you couldn't even compete for a government contract if you had a major official in your company who was a Jew, or a major official in your company who'd been associated with some political party other than the Nazis. And so they basically, through a combination of carrot and stick, you know, bullying and withdrawing enticements or extending enticements and so forth, brought people around to line. And the business community in Germany collapsed very fast in the face of this. Hitler came into office at the end of January. By early April, so really we're talking, you know, 2 months, by early April, most large business associations in Germany had signaled that they would do exactly what the Nazi Party asked of them. They had fired their Jewish employees. They had removed Jews from their various boards and so forth. And so there was a kind of quick capitulation to the demands of the Nazis. And usually the justification within the people who made these decisions was, we have to do this for the good of the firm. It's the best way for the firm to survive.
Yeah. So you characterize the evolving German economy as a monopsony.
Monopsony.
Yeah. How did the regime's war effort alter basic supply and demand relationships through the use of incentives and coercion?
Maybe we should tell your listeners what a monopsony is. Everybody knows what a monopoly is. A monopoly is a market that's controlled by a single seller. A monopsony is a market that's controlled by a single buyer. And in Germany, the predominant buyer in the 1930s was the state. The recovery from the Depression was funded by state expenditure. But unlike in the United States, where it went a lot into public works and things like that as part of the New Deal, in Germany, the emphasis was on two things: armament expenditure, so steel factories, tank factories, artillery factories, and so forth, and import substitution, that is, making goods that would replace things that you brought into the country. And the way the Nazis persuaded industry to cooperate with that is basically they said, we'll offer you very advantageous contracts. If you start a company that will make gasoline from coal, which we have a lot of in Germany, instead of gasoline from crude oil that we have to totally import, then we will pay you more than the going rate to do that out of the government budget. And we will guarantee you depreciation of your factory within 10 years, a profit margin of 5%, and we'll buy it all. The state will buy it all. Your market is absolutely assured. There were a couple of, and that worked for gasoline from coal. On the whole, there were a couple of coal companies that were recalcitrant. And so what the government did is it used its power to decree that those companies had to collectively form a company to make the gasoline from coal. And they had to invest, each of them had to put in 10% of the stock, the initial capital. So what you're doing here is you're creating both the market and the provider. And they did this for gasoline from coal because that was their biggest import, crude oil. But they also did it for synthetic fibers, rayon, because the second biggest import of Germany was wool and cotton, and they didn't want to keep buying that from abroad. So this is what they do. They altered, the government provides the incentive to do something, and then the government structures the market so you have to do it. You have to participate in providing that commodity.
Did any companies not go that way? Did any of the coal companies decide?
Because he has the power to rule by decree, the coal companies that initially said no, which were all producers of brown coal, they were basically conscripted into making this company. The fiber companies, it was a little bit more resistance. And what they did is they sweetened it. They said, okay, we're going to require of all German makers of clothing that they have a 10% admixture of the synthetic fibers. So then they made that market basically set up. And so the producers were reassured by that. and because they've got a captive market now, and they came in. So it was like, you see, it's a carrot and stick process. Yeah. Historians have had a lot of trouble classifying the Nazi economy. Was it capitalist? Because, you know, they didn't nationalize much in the way of production. Was it socialist? Well, not really, because they don't nationalize. It's a mix. It's a carrot and stick economy to do what the state wants.
Yeah. You have a chapter called, I think, De-Jewification. And in the early 30s, we talked a little bit about how there was, you know, sort of a move away from business with Jewish-owned firms. Talk a little bit about the de-Jewification process, which, and how big businesses, some of whom had, you know, longstanding senior executives who were Jewish, how did they react and did they resist in any way?
Well, before 1933, the Nazis had agitated very strongly for removing Jews and Jewish influence from Germany. So everybody knew this was what the Nazis wanted to do. What they didn't know is how. And a lot of big business leaders thought, you know, they're not talking about the kind of guys I know, my banker or my buddy from another company who I meet with periodically to make decisions and so forth. These are good, respectable people. The Nazis won't go after those Jews. They'll go after foreign Jews, the people who've come into Germany since 1918. There were about 100,000 Jews from Eastern Europe who had migrated into Germany in the 19-teens and 20s. Those business leaders tended to reassure themselves that they're not talking about people like me. They're talking about these other people, and then they'll go after them. Now, what they found out in the spring of 1933 was, no, the Nazis were going after all the Jews. And then, however, they realized that the Nazis could be dealt with because the Nazis needed the cooperation of business to recover from the Depression. So a good relationship could develop on every other issue except that one. And the way they collectively concluded to buy the Nazis off was to throw the Jews to the wolves. And they did. By 1934, a year and a half after Hitler came in, two-thirds of the Jews who had been directors of the leading enterprises in Germany had lost their jobs already in the first 18 months.
So now what steps did the big banks like Deutsche and Dresdner take to profit during the Aryanization process?
Well, the banks were torn at the beginning because on the one hand, if you tried to drive Jewish factory owners or shopkeepers out of the economy, you'd have to have someone to replace them with. And the kind of people the Nazis tended to favor to take over these operations tended to be party loyalists who didn't have a whole lot of experience. The bankers were worried about losing money on their investments. And so at first, they were reluctant to participate in massive deprivations of Jewish property owners. In their own boards, they fired everybody right away. But down the line in the rest of the country, they were cautious because there was money at stake and they didn't want to. But over time, the Nazi pressure on Jewish owners of smaller businesses and shops and so forth became so intense that the bankers began to think, we're going to lose more money if they stay in possession of these operations than if they sell out. And at that moment, the banks tend to switch. And it comes for different banks at different moments. Roughly 1937 is the pivot. And by 1937, most of the big banks are trying to persuade the factory owners and shopkeepers across the country who are Jews, who bank with them. They're trying to persuade them to sell out. So it's an escalating process in which private interest gradually turns more and more persecutorial.
How directly was big business involved in the use of conscripted labor during the war? As we've been talking about the German economy, they're obviously spending enormous amounts on armaments and goods. And you sort of wonder how do the numbers work that this economy could survive through any long run. One of the things I know they turned to was conscripted labor.
Yeah, one of the bottlenecks for the German economy was the population. Germany is a mid-sized country, still is. In those days, even with the expanded borders of the 1938-39, they came to about 80 million people. And then when the war started, you start drafting most of the able-bodied men into the military. You're pulling them out of factories. Germany had a massive labor shortage, and it was not alleviated We tend in the United States to think back on World War II and we have the romance of Rosie the Riveter. And we think, well, you know, the way we got through the war is we got a lot of women into the industrial workforce and so forth. But Germany already had, in 1939, when the war began, a larger percentage of its women working in industry than ever happened in the United States during World War II. So before there was Rosie the Riveter, there was, in German, Helga die Nieterin. And there were lots of Helgas. And so there was not elasticity in the labor force to replace the men called up with women. And this the Germans therefore faced a problem. They could either farm out production to idle factories in occupied countries in Europe, so have your all the things you need produced in France and the Netherlands and Denmark and so forth, or you could bring the idle laborers from those occupied countries into Germany. And the role business played in this decision was basically business didn't like the idea of farming out production because other countries would acquire know-how or specialized knowledge that could later in peacetime be used against the German companies. So well, they wanted to keep as much production at home as possible. And then you add to that that the Nazi policymakers were rapacious and were not interested in helping local economies develop. So these things came together to reinforce the notion of rounding up labor all over Europe. We tend to think nowadays of the most sensational aspects of this were obviously people who were taken out of concentration camps and put to work. But in fact, there were 10 times as many people as those concentration camp laborers who were rounded up from France to Ukraine, just dragooning them off the streets and bringing them to Germany and putting them to work in factories. So almost every major German corporation was involved in this. Most major corporations, particularly if they produced for the military, were involved in using concentration camp labor, especially after 1943. And so it's a widespread practice.
And moving from merely using conscripted labor to manufacture goods and service, what role did big business play in the mechanics of the actual annihilation of Jews in Germany and other occupied countries?
Well, they provided the means. I think anyone who knows anything about this subject knows that there were chemical companies that made Zyklon. And Zyklon was the gas of choice at Auschwitz and to a lesser extent at Majdanek. Most of the other camps, people were gassed by carbon monoxide, and that was not produced by anything except a gasoline engine. But the gas chambers at Birkenau had electricity. They had lighting. That was provided by AEG, which is the German General Electric. The construction operations at Birkenau were financed largely from loans from the Dresdner Bank and the Deutsche Bank in the nearest big city, which was Katowice. So they provided the wherewithal. They also functioned as middlemen. When the Jews were collected and they were stripped of their property, that money was deposited in bank accounts. And for the Deutsche Bank and the Dresdner Bank, they tended to use their subsidiaries in Prague as the place where these bank accounts were collected. They were the largest depositors at those banks in 1943, 44, 45. So there was a lot of enabling that went on by the corporate sector.
And so these business officials in the corporate sector there were, to what extent were they held accountable for their roles in Nazi war crimes after the war?
Well, there were varying degrees of accountability. I mean, some of them were captured by the Soviets, and almost all of those died, either by their own hand or by execution right away. Some died at hard labor a few years later and so forth. The ones that were captured by the Americans, the British, and the French, there were some sensational trials. The board of directors of IG Farben was put on trial. A couple of officials out of the Dresdner Bank were put on trial. Krupp, the armaments firm, some of the board of directors there were put on trial. But the punishments were relatively short, and they were almost all pardoned in 1951 by the American occupation authorities. So the longest prison sentence was 6 years. Almost everybody below the very, very senior levels in this company got away with everything they did. And They were in the course of the 1950s, most of them returned to office in firms or on boards or as consultants, and they were remunerated well and so forth. So the bottom line is a few people were spectacularly publicized and there were some punishments handed down, but most people got off without any punishment.
Yeah. You talk in the book about how, as in so many things, there are competing narratives about the role of big business in the German war effort. Well, how is it rationalized?
It was rationalized by the same way the people at the time did it, that it was their way of bringing the enterprise through dark times.
Yeah.
And therefore, they were justified in doing whatever they did as long as the company survived, as long as the employees continued to have their livelihood, and so on.
Okay. We've been speaking with Peter Hayes, author of the new book, Profits and Persecution, German Big Business and the Nazi Economy and the Holocaust. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
My pleasure.
We'll be right back after this.
It's a proverb most of us have heard many times. Necessity is the mother of invention, but it can have many different meanings to many different people. One local business saw a need, and while trying to solve it, they found themselves in the fight against carbon buildup in our atmosphere. Here to fill in some details is Daryl Huntsman from CO2 Sink. Good morning, and thank you for joining us on Mountain Money.
Good morning, Kevin.
Well, let's just dive right in. Did I get that correct? What need did you see or did you have?
So there are multiple needs that we're addressing. The first was the business, our sister companies. We built big timber frame homes and creating a lot of wood waste. We're wondering, well, what do we do with that wood waste? And we wanted to have a very productive and effective use of that wood waste. And that turned into using biochar. But biochar has multiple uses. Mm-hmm. One is the biggest use is in agriculture and soil remediation. And so there's a big benefit for using biochar in agriculture. But then we started to see another problem or challenge out there, which was our forests. And our forests have significant destruction through beetle infestation. Yeah. And we said, okay, well, we can solve that problem too. And then we saw another problem out there, which is CO2 emissions. And with CO2 emissions through beetle kill forests and wildfires, we saw a need to solve that problem. So all of these things are coming together that we solve with it, CO2 sink.
So that is kind of the solution to that original need. So how does the solution, or does it, fight climate change? Is it by taking the dead wood out of the forest?
Yeah, so what we do is when you're trying to reduce greenhouse gases, the first is what is emitting a greenhouse gas? And one is the decomposition of forests. The second is wildfire from forests. Mm-hmm. So you need to take that carbon that would normally be emitted into the atmosphere and sequester that carbon. Well, what we do through our process, through pyrolysis, is that we sequester that carbon and remove it from the atmosphere and permanently and place that into the soil and use it as a soil enhancer. Mm-hmm. And so no longer is that carbon emitted, but it's sequestered into the soil.
So that's interesting. So biochar includes a lot of carbon?
Yes.
And so and it's sort of like the dog food ad. Plants like it?
Yeah. So biochar, maybe even back up. Well, you know, what is biochar?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's probably a better place to start. So biochar is a carbon-rich material. And that's one characteristic of it, is the chemical properties. It's carbon. That's organic material. That's what our plants, that's what life thrives on. The second part of biochar that makes it really interesting is the mechanical structure, what it physically looks like. And it's a very, very porous structure. And because of that porosity, when you put it into the soil, not only are you adding carbon back into the soil, but you're creating a habitat for all the microbes to live and thrive. It's a way for moisture to be retained in the soil. It breaks up the soil. If it's a very clayey soil, it'll break that up, and it allows the plants to thrive. And then fertilizers and all the other nutrients that plants need, instead of washing off and going into the rivers and so forth, they are retained at the root system
because
with biochar.
Because of the biochar. Right. So the biochar also holds the water. So if it rains once a week, it is absorbing that water so it doesn't run off, and then it's releasing that water?
Yeah, it just retains that water, and then it releases that water as needed when the plants say, okay, I need more water. See, the other thing that's interesting about biochar is it has a very high cationic exchange rate. What that means is that the plants are sending these electric pulses of signals, and you want to have that high exchange so that that communication is very clear. And with that, the plant can say, okay, we need these nutrients, we need this moisture, we need this, and those plants are receiving that very quickly and efficiently. The other thing, though, with the water, and this is highly relevant for Utah and the Western United States, is that it helps in water conservation.
Yeah.
So we've seen studies, and we've looked at this, and all these turf management companies and golf courses, they can use about 20% less water if they put the biochar at the root system, because it holds that water in there.
So do they till? Do they get biochar from you and then till it into the soil and then plant?
Ideally, you put it in there before you plant. So it's 3 to 4 inches underneath the plant system.
Does this work in my home garden?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Is the biochar readily available?
Yes. Yeah. The biochar that we have and that we sell it in big bulk, big bags.
Your yard's not that big.
But we sell in 2 cubic yard big sacks.
No, that's not bad at all.
But you can also get it at Home Depot and some of these other smaller bag sizes.
So now backing up to the forest devastation from the pine bark beetle. Yeah. Do you go up into the mountains and grab the logs?
Yes, we go up. We work very closely with the U.S. Forest Service and the Utah Department of Natural Resources, the DNR, and they've identified all these areas where forest has been really decimated by this beetle kill. And we go up, we harvest that, and if they're huge, big diameter type of timbers, then we can use those in construction. If they're not, we can chip those up and use those in production of our biochar.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
So biochar was one term from your website I didn't understand.
Okay.
And the other is pyrolysis.
What is
pyrolysis?
So pyrolysis is the process, is the technical term for the process in which we make biochar.
Oh, okay.
So pyrolysis is taking biomass, in our case wood chips, and you heat it up in an oxygen-depleted zone. So very, very little oxygen. We heat it up to around 1300 degrees Fahrenheit. What that does is that drives all of the volatiles off of the wood. And so what you're left with is carbon coming out the end. And so that's where we're sequestering that carbon that would have otherwise been burnt and goes up into the atmosphere. And now we have that biochar and this carbon that's used.
Gotcha. So so we just mentioned the National Forest Service. So I understand that our Senator Curtis is trying to get a bipartisan act through Congress called Fix Our Forests. Is CO2 Sync part of that, or can CO2 Sync be part of that?
No, it's absolutely a part of that, and we're happy for this. This is an act that both sides of the aisle agree on. Last year alone, Utah had a 54% increase in the number of wildfires. There were over 1,200 reported wildfires in Utah. they're trying to figure out, well, what do we do with this? How are we going to manage our forests better? How do we keep those the forests clean? We've seen what happened in California, the devastation with those wildfires, and then just even managing the forests. Without forests, you get erosion. Biodiversity goes down when you have rich forests, as we can all see in the the tropical forest, a lot of diversity in all kinds of animal life. That's what you want. And so we're part of that. We take out that dead forest. We supply back into the forest. 10% of our biochar goes back in to help replenish and work with reforestation.
Gotcha. So how long have you been doing this?
Well, the company started in 2003, but we've launched our first plant just this year.
Oh, good.
Excuse me, 2023. But we launched our first plant this last year.
And how can our listeners get more information? What is the website?
It's www.co2-sync.com.
Is it the number two or?
The number two, yes.
Okay, so CO2.
With the number two.
Dash. Wonderful. What's next down the road?
Well, we have plans to open up over 54 of these locations throughout throughout the Mountain West, and we have two more coming in Carbon County this next year.
That is fantastic. Yeah. Thank you very much for joining us.
Absolutely.
Daryl Huntsman from CO2 Sync, thank you, and we'll be back in just a sec.
Wasteless Solution is a nonprofit that is committed to reducing food waste in Utah. Here to talk about it is WLS Area Director Julianne Caron. Morning, Julianne. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Julianne, can you share a bit about the history of the organization and its mission?
Sure. So we started in Salt Lake City in 2018 with our founder, Dana Williamson. And then since then, we have expanded to Box Elder County, Weber County, and now Summit County. And our primary goal is to feed more people wasteless food. Pretty simple.
Now, I understand, is this a regional office? How do you describe the operation here in Park City?
Yeah, it is. It's an area or regional office. So I solely represent Summit County and the Wasatch Back. And we have our own offices up here. And we're a separate licensed entity in Summit County.
Nice. And so wasteless, is it national?
No.
Okay.
It is
Utah.
Founded local. Yes, okay. Founded okay. Right here in Salt Lake. Yeah.
Okay, so Julianne, can you explain some of the things that the organization has done in the past that leads up to what you're doing now?
Sure. So definitely started with food rescue. So food rescue is going out to those entities and organizations that have surplus edible food at the end of their event or day or work or whatever you call it, and redistributing that to those that are food insecure. Some of the big partners that we have down in Salt Lake include the Utah Jazz, the Salt Lake Convention Center, Mountain America Expo Center, Great Harvest Bread. At the end of every day or event, they have so much amazing, good quality food that was just going into the garbage. And so we started seeing that need, rescuing that food, getting it to organizations like The Road Home, The Food Pantry, Utah Food Bank, YWCA, all these organizations that can then use that food. And then, of course, what's not rescuable, what's not divertible, we're trying to keep that out of the landfill.
So are you arranging for composting and things like that?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. We partner almost solely now with Momentum Recycling, doing food recycling, both in Salt Lake as well as up here in Summit County.
Cool. Just so I can get a picture of this. So if I go to a conference down in Salt Lake and there's 200 people there, there's always going to be some leftover food. We contact you or the caterers contact you and take care of the food from there?
Yeah, it usually has to be arranged ahead of time. It's not kind of an impromptu thing as easy because you just need...
I got some cold cut. Come pick them up.
Yeah, exactly. You have to arrange. So we have almost a solely volunteer workforce. So we have to arrange for those volunteers. We have to work with the facility that's donating the food as well as the agency that's receiving the food. So it takes a little bit of coordination, and we have a software program that manages all that. So when someone's having an event, they kind of reach out ahead of time, or we have a pre-existing, you know, contract or whatever with them to let us know when they have events, about how much they think it might be, approximation of leftovers. And then we have our volunteers go pick that food up, take it to the receiving agency that they've designated. It's a little bit complicated when you do catering events like that, big events like that, because there's certain foods that are rescuable and there's certain foods that aren't rescuable. So, for example, you know, I'll use our local Rotary Lunch Club, right? We have a buffet every week at lunch, and after everyone's served themselves, there's still food remaining on the buffet table. That food's not rescuable.
Is it a food safety issue?
It is. It's exactly that. It's a food safety health licensing issue. We can't box that up and redistribute that. However, as most people are familiar with a buffet table, right, you run out of a tray of something, and the kind people from the back bring out a new tray, and they take the empty tray away, and there's a new tray put in its place. Anything that's still trayed in the back and hasn't been brought out to that buffet is rescuable because it's still controlled under food safety and food licensing standards. So that food can then be packaged and redistributed. But once it's placed on that buffet table for people to self-serve, it's no longer rescuable food.
Gotcha. So when you said you, in advance, you know who. Is it the catering company, the facility, or the company that's putting on the event?
It could be any of them. Usually, if it's the person putting on the event, they have to usually work with the facility ahead of time, because that food has to be packaged somehow, right? And so that's usually coming from whoever the caterer or the hotel or the event center that's doing it is preparing that food for transport after the event. So it just kind of depends. If you're doing an event where maybe it's wrapped sandwiches or boxed lunches, then sometimes it's already prepackaged, and you know, you hand out, you order 100 boxed lunches because you don't know how many people are going to come, and maybe you get 75 attendees and you have 25 extra boxed lunches. That organizer then could just take those boxed lunches from there and either self-donate them or arrange ahead of time for one of our volunteers to pick up those extras and redistribute.
Good. And so you get any pushback from caterers or facilities saying, yeah, that's too much work to put it all together?
It is a little bit, right? Yeah. And that organization has to be committed to that, because there is a small cost. I don't want to say there's a lot of cost, but it is the time and money to have people repackage that food, and the type of packaging that they're putting it in. Now, some organizations just drop it into Ziploc bags for us, and that's okay. Others want to put it in more, say, to-go containers, or they put them in aluminum trays that are wrapped. One of the things we can't do at this point in time, unfortunately, is like take their, you know, like pans, like their real kitchenware and stuff like that, take the food somewhere and bring their pans back. So it has to be in something
one-way trip
that is not going to come back to them. Yeah. So.
Gotcha. And I imagine shrimp cocktail can't be donated.
Not very easily.
Okay. So and that does give rise to an interesting issue. Do you have to manage refrigeration requirements as well? Is that a complexity for you?
Yes. I mean, obviously, food will spoil if not kept at the right temperatures. So we look at when we pick it up, we pick it up and immediately take it to a receiver that can accept that food. So that's always the key part, because different types of donated food can only be received by certain kinds of receivers, depending on their licensing, their capability, whether they have refrigeration. There's several factors that we have to take into account. So we have to look at each rescue to figure out what kind of receiver will work with that kind of food.
Sounds like logistics are very, very important.
It is. It's not hard once you learn the basics. It's just directing a lot of times the donor to understand we can't take that product here because of this. So is it okay if we take it there?
And we've been talking a lot about what I would call supply side. I want to move over a little bit in demand side, and I want to talk about your new app. What is the Hungry with Two E's app?
Oh, so this is, I think this is going to be an amazing addition to our toolbox. We're beta testing this here in Park City, and if successful, we are going to take it statewide throughout the entire state of Utah. But it's a way to eliminate what we were talking about, the logistics issues, right? Mm. The problem of getting, arranging ahead of time, knowing how much extra food you're going to have, arranging for a volunteer to pick that up, making sure that a receiving agency can accept it. So what we're doing is taking this directly from the donor to what we call the hungry, right?
The end so, user.
Yeah, the user, somebody that needs it. So what we're currently doing is we're signing up restaurants, any licensed food business in Summit County can be a donor, and they can direct donate those to anybody who needs a meal. And they simply do it through our free app.
So it's almost taking the big picture that we were talking about earlier and bringing it down to the person-to-person level.
Exactly. In an individual or family meal size. Sometimes we get donated large portions of catered food, and we don't have a way to break that down into a manageable meal size. This, the restaurant takes on that responsibility. So it's somewhat like a to-go order. They package
it's like,
it just
like DoorDash for the hungry.
Exactly. Right. Exactly.
Oh, I imagine that could happen if someone doesn't pick up a to-go order. Boom.
Exactly.
One
of our very first restaurants that signed up, Estes Pizza, that's exactly what they're what they have is every once in a while someone will place an order for, say, five pizzas, and then nobody shows up to pick up that order, and they've got five brand new pizzas sitting there with no one picking them up. This way, they'll be able to put those pizzas on the app, and anybody that wants to come claim a free pizza can do it. And the nice thing about the app is the restaurant can choose how they portion that. So they can either say, hey, we have five pizzas, here's what the five pizzas are, or they could say, we have five individual pizzas, right? Mm-hmm, and so there's one pepperoni, one veggie, one, you know, they can put them on the app however they choose. And then people confirm the pickup. So the hungry goes on, says, yes, I claim that pizza.
I'm on the way.
And they can limit the amount of time, too. So it's kind of nice. And distance. Our hungries can look for food that's within a certain vicinity of them. So depending on their transportation ability and things mm-hmm. like that, they can search from as little as 100 feet, I think it is, up to 10 miles. And then once they confirm it, the restaurant confirms it's theirs. And they come in, they have a code, they show their code, and they say, here's your pizza.
And just so our listeners, if they're interested, Hungry, H-U-N-G-R-E-E,
yes.
The app is up on both the Apple and Microsoft, Google Store.
Google Store, right. Yes, it is. And it's completely free to use. And anybody can sign up.
And is there a website associated with Wasteless Solutions?
Yep, we have wastelesssolutions.org. We currently do not have Hungry App information up on there because that is our website for the state, and we are only beta testing this in Park City right now. So you can also go to thehungryapp.com and find out more information about the app. The app can be food sharing in the whole community. We currently have set up what we call a community village called Wasteless Park City, which all the donors are licensed food businesses here in Park City. And so if hungries go on there and they want to look for that kind of food, it's going to be on our village, and anybody in the community can access food through there.
Cool. Real quick, what local restaurants right here are on the Hungry app providing?
We are working on signing everybody up. We are launching this officially Memorial Weekend. So right now we are in the sign-up phase. So we do have several restaurants interested, but we haven't quite finalized yet, so I don't want to list those names. Mm-hmm. But we are working with the Park City Restaurant Association, the Park City Climate Fund, the Business Cohort, the Green Business Program, the Health Department, a lot of support.
And again, and when the app goes live at Memorial Day, all those restaurants will be listed so that you can see the ones that have something available.
Exactly.
You don't really need to know the ones that have signed up but don't have anything, right?
Right, okay. Right. Some of our caterers and cafeterias may not have something on a regular basis. Some restaurants may have some stuff more regularly.
We've been speaking with Julianne Carone of Wasteless Solutions about the new Hungry, H-U-N-G-R-E-E app and other activities engaged by Wasteless Solutions. Thanks for spending time with us.
Thanks.
We'll be right back after this.